This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. In a region known for its lack of affordable housing, Southwest Florida has a fair number of rental housing units, meaning many of the homes damaged by Hurricane Irma were occupied by people who aren't the owners of the dwelling. In the second half of our show, we'll talk with a Collier County attorney about what renters should do to make sure they're covered. But first, a book released this month called Liquid Landscape, Geography and Settlement at the Edge of Early America takes a look at the state of Florida, where, as the book points out, land and water frequently change places with little warning, dissolving homes and communities, along with the very concepts of boundaries themselves. That imagery is all too real for many Southwest Floridians after Hurricane Irma made landfall 4 weeks ago. Areas like Everglades City saw up to 10 feet of storm surge, and nearly a month later, many on this coast are still trying to find a way forward in Florida's liquid landscape. The book discusses the cycle of settlement and destruction in Florida and raises the question of whether or not that history will only continue to repeat itself. We're joined today by its author, Miami University of Ohio Professor Michelle Navakis. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
You can be part of this conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Michelle, how did you first become interested in this subject?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Well, I actually grew up in Southeast Florida, and so I think living there most of my life and going through the cycle of preparing for hurricanes and that terror of waiting for them to arrive, and then thinking about why we might occupy this landscape in the first place, it's really familiar to me. So I wanted to write a book that explored that within historical perspective.
Well, so you're from South Florida. Have you actually experienced a hurricane here before?
Oh, yeah, many times growing up, boarding up the house and waiting and seeing what happens. I've been really lucky because actually that waiting has been the worst of it for me. And I think when you've gone through a lot of hurricanes, you realize that if you're really lucky, it's that preliminary time that's actually the worst of it. And I wish I could just say the same for so many other people who experienced Irma and other hurricanes that had such horrible aftermaths.
Yeah, people who haven't actually had the house blown away will easily say that the waiting's the worst part. But the worst part really if it does actually hit you.
Yes, yes, very much so.
What was it like this time for you to watch from afar as Hurricane Irma encroached on your hometown?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say the same again. I mean, I was worried about that same kind of thing. It was days of just being terrified. I have family on both coasts, actually, I'll say. So I have a lot of family in the Tampa area, too, and in Pasco County. And watching as the storm changed track, first heading toward the East Coast and then the West Coast, I can't even imagine what that was like for people who are actually living there.
Yeah, it was really scary thinking about the possibility of that storm surge hitting the entire coast. But then it went inland.
Absolutely.
So we kind of dodged that. Well,
yeah.
Many of the people in Florida did. So when natural disasters like this happen, a lot of people start questioning whether or not Florida should be inhabited at all. And I actually sat across the table from someone in San Francisco once who said no one has any business living in Florida. It's just a sandbar. Meanwhile, they're sitting on a fault line and her house is perched high in the Oakland Hills. I mean, do you think people still should be living here in Florida?
Yeah, well, I noticed too, and especially in the wake of Hurricane Irma, people wrote all these articles, the New York Times, Politico, basically saying Florida wasn't meant to be inhabited in the first place. This is a really familiar claim in our culture today. It actually has 18th century roots. So if you look back to colonial maps and travel narratives, they really did declare Florida underdeveloped, backward, problematic, generally doomed to remain outside the real story of American settlement. With my book, I wanted to revise that conception. Florida actually has a very long history of settlement, as you and I'm sure many know who are listening, settlement by people who could adapt to its landscape. So I think a better question we should be asking is how have people throughout history actually managed to live on this landscape successfully? And those are the stories that I really wanted to tell in this book. Because I think if we look closely at its history, we see how many people managed to live through an awareness and an adaptation to that land in really interesting ways.
So what are some of the more interesting ways that you've seen people adapt to the land?
Yeah, well, in the book, I talk about, particularly in Southwest Florida, how the Colusa, an indigenous population, lived for roughly 2,000 years before European contact. And I tell the story of how they did this by building homes that essentially, I think the best term for those homes would be floating islands. These are movable platforms that are tethered by straps to upright pillars of timber anchored into the ground. And what this meant for them is that when the waters rose, as they inevitably would, the homes would also rise rather than capsizing, being flooded, or being swept away. We have the Seminole, who began arriving in Florida during the early 19th century, who lived on rises of dry ground, and they knew to move seasonally so that the water table would never overwhelm where they were living. And the point of this is not, okay, we need to build these, you know, movable platforms and live on rises of dry ground. I think the lesson from all of these things is we need to be aware of that landscape and adapt to the particularities of the place.
Yeah, understanding the landscape and then being able to adapt to it seems to be, it kind of makes like common sense, but right. You've seen throughout history there are many ways in which people have refused to adapt, and they've put seawalls and canals and trying to force the nature to go where they want it to go.
Yeah.
I think that when you were studying this, when you're looking at this over history, are you looking at that the folly of trying to master Mother Nature?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the stories that I tell is the construction of Fort Jefferson on the Dry Tortugas, 70 miles west of Key West. And if people don't know that location, I mean, it's this totally isolated place. There are islands that are barely even islands. And the U.S. government, starting in the 1840s, attempted to build a gigantic structure, Fort Jefferson, to house 1,500 people in wartime on these islands. And basically, that entire story is a really good lesson in how to fail to adapt to a liquid landscape. The fort basically began sinking right as it was being constructed, and continued to do so through roughly four decades of construction, much of it done by slave labor. And finally, after being ravaged by hurricanes and floods and tides for that many decades, the government finally said, you know what, this isn't working. And why do we need to do that, right? I mean, there has to be another way. And it's not always up to the individual. It's up to things like zoning laws, and things like that, to sort of be aware of what we're really building on here.
Yeah, it's not an individual decision to make most of the time.
Right, exactly.
So people often think of Florida as somehow different than the rest of the continental U.S., but your book suggests that this sense of it being different took shape early on in our nation's history. To what extent was this mindset influenced by Florida's watery ground?
Yeah, I mean, I think it. What's interesting about Florida, and I try to bring this out in the book, is we know that all land is always changing continually. This is a reality of the ground. But what Florida does is it brings that sense to the fore, or at least it did in the 18th and 19th centuries when you could actually see the landscape. I think modern changes have made it almost difficult to know where we're actually living now. But during the 18th and 19th centuries, people had that sense of shifting. I mean, where else on the continent do you have the combination of a limestone foundation, shifting shorelines, enormous amounts of swampland? I mean, in fact, over half of Florida's 20 million acres during a lot of the period I write about was, in fact, swamp. And then a place that's also, on top of that, continually ravaged by hurricanes. So I think Florida just brings to the fore this kind of shifting ground that, in fact, is happening everywhere. And I think the chance that Florida provides and the opportunity it provides by doing that is the opportunity to change and to adapt.
So was there some debate back in the day about whether Florida should even become a state?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it wasn't really up to the U.S. entirely to make that decision. Florida was always interesting to our nation's founders, going back to the very beginning of the foundation of the country. But the problem was, as with a lot of landscapes, of course, people already live there. So the challenge that that Florida brought to the fore then was the challenge of slavery. What was happening during this time period, in fact, going back to the 17th century, is that these communities of people escaping slavery are coming south to live in the Everglades. You know, we usually think about people on plantations who want to escape slavery going north. But Florida has a whole history that shows us people went south also. And this was a big threat, as you might imagine, to the early U.S. They were very worried about the continuance of the institution of slavery throughout the entire nation. And so in that way, the Everglades were really a topic of national concern and national interest, as was most of Florida for this period.
So leaders then looked at it as a place of refuge, but did they want it to not be that?
Absolutely. They wanted it to not be that at all.
They wanted to reel it in and take control of it.
Yeah. In fact, that's why Andrew Jackson invades Florida in 1818, is to try to take it back from the Spain. The idea was that Spain was doing a terrible job. And of course, Spain was doing a terrible job because Spain, it was actually to their advantage to, they weren't actually doing a terrible job. It was to their advantage to keep this this aggression up against the U.S. Invading. So populations of escaped slaves and Seminoles would join together. And sometimes the Spanish would even arm them to sort of resist U.S. expansion.
I don't think there are many people that live in Florida that even know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, there were three Seminole Wars. I mean, they're now called the Seminole Wars, but they happened between 1818 and 1858. So what's fascinating to me is there was one of these wars, the last one, actually happened after Florida was a state in 1845. So it was declared a state, and then like 10, 13 years later, they still are fighting these wars to remove and expunge these populations from Florida. So you can see what a problem it was causing.
Well, it's interesting because it seems like people weren't even 100% sure exactly how much of Florida was even there, because the maps that you had throughout your book, they were completely inaccurate. It just shows it kind of falling off.
Yeah, thanks, Julie, for noticing that. The maps are so interesting. They're one of the first things that drew me to this project. During the story of mapping Florida from the 16th to the 19th centuries is just a fascinating one. There was so much disagreement about what it looked like. You had some explorers reporting back, hey, this is an island, not connected to the continent at all. Others said, no, it's a peninsula, definitely connected. But then there are all these maps of people who actually believed that most of Florida was islands, like small islands that sort of spread south and east into the Caribbean. So you have all these different maps that show it as different island configurations. And so, you know, map makers are just basing their maps on descriptions. But when you have all these different maps and all these different descriptions, yeah, no one could even precisely tell the boundaries of Florida, and then consequently where the U.S. or where the continent ended and the Caribbean began.
Yeah, I mean, you think about that. And also, as you mentioned, it's kind of always shifting, you know? So one guy's description may have been accurate one week, and then a couple months later, it's completely different. High tide, different. A hurricane came through, changed the configuration, made this particular island look a little bit further away, so that's no longer part of what we're considering the peninsula. So that had to be difficult for the United States to figure out where to put their boundary.
Yeah, there's no question. There's a lot of contest and debate about that. You know, one of the interesting things to me is that a lot of these maps were very much based on interviews that I guess they could be called interviews. That's a little too formal. But that people who would go to Florida from other parts of the South for different reasons, let's say on slave raids or to make a map, they would come down to Florida and they would have no understanding of the peninsula, so they would have to ask local populations. So a lot of the configurations we see on these maps are very much informed by indigenous local populations trying to explain to Europeans, hey, here's what the landscape looked like. So you can imagine that would not always produce the most accurate maps.
Well, and even though they did describe that it's incredibly hot and mosquito infested, you still had soldiers being armed to come down here and wearing, you know, wool clothing from up in New England.
Yeah.
Which did not serve them too well.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Incredibly uncomfortable. And you're dealing with people who really know their way around because, as you mentioned, adapted to the landscape.
Yeah, there's no question. So, you know, I tell this story of all this literature. I mean, I guess I want to mention this is a literary study. It's mostly looking at stories and impressions and the experience that people recorded in novels and short stories, in poetry and maps. Of this particular landscape.
How were you able to collect all of these? Is this through in-person interviews with descendants, or how did you get all of this information?
I actually didn't do any of those kinds of interviews, but so as a literary scholar, what I was interested in finding out is whether people were actually writing about this place and who was reading this literature. And all of the text that I analyze in the book, it turns out almost all of them are published during the 18th and 19th centuries and actually quite well read and widely circulated in major U.S. cities during this time period. And what this tells us is that there was significant interest and significant fascination with even the furthest southern shifting edges of the continent during a period of our nation's founding. And we actually tend to think about this period. When we think of it, we think of particular locations like maybe New England or the Mid-Atlantic seaboard. But what I wanted to show in this book, in Liquid Landscape, is that Florida is also part of this narrative, too. And so you asked about where I found some of this literature, and I would like to say that it might be surprising to people to learn that some well-known authors actually either moved to or wrote about Florida. So Harriet Beecher Stowe, I think people might not know, actually after writing Uncle Tom's Cabin, years later, she moves to Florida, lives there, writes an entire book of letters in 1873. James Fenimore Cooper, he's best known for writing The Last of the Mohicans and other frontier novels. He has an entire novel, really popular during this time period, that is called Jack Tyr or The Florida Reef, entirely set on the Florida Reef.
So how did people at that time perceive Florida? Did they find it kind of a wild frontier?
Yeah, I think it depends on who you ask. And the perception definitely changed over time. And that's something that I try to chart in the book. But it really did depend on who you ask. So a lot of people did perceive it as this sort of wild frontier. It was kind of hopeless and couldn't be settled. But then you have some really interesting works from this time. One of them, one of my favorites, is called The Exiles of Florida. And this is published by an Ohio abolitionist. And he basically tells the entire story of Florida's settlement and founding from the perspective, well, to the best of his ability, from the perspective of populations living on the ground, including Maroon communities. So he tells the story from the perspective of Seminole Indians and their allies, escaped slaves, and what it was like to live there on that landscape. So he's really trying to see it from a different mode, not as a resistant landscape that's keeping people out, but as a place that is in fact home with a history of being people's homes.
Listeners can join our conversation with Michelle Navakas, the author of Liquid Landscape, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And you say that understanding how people felt about Florida's landscape during the period before and just after the Revolutionary War can help us better understand how the nation as a whole thought of itself. How so?
Well, I think when you look at writing about Florida from this period, a question that is front and center, almost no matter what type of writing you're looking at, meaning whether it's short stories, novels, even maps or surveys, is the question of who already knows this landscape best. People were very much aware, in the case of Florida, that this ground belonged to other people. For example, that the wreckers who lived along the Florida Reef, these are people who salvage ships when they wreck and sometimes even cause those shipwrecks to take the salvage, that those people knew that ground best. I'm not sure you would get that same story of settlement if you are only looking at more widely read works about, say, settling New England. You don't always get the sense of like who else knows this landscape, who's already there, what other enclaves and populations know this ground and know this geography.
I think that may be rooted in the fact that it's kind of a tough place to find your way if you're used to other types of landscapes and weather patterns and topography. So, I mean, I think even today, people that move down here to Florida want to know more about who lived here before and why they did that. I mean, that's one of the major questions we get sometimes on this show. Why did people come here in the first place?
Yeah. And I mean, I hope what I'm making clear is that it definitely depends on who you ask. People had very different objectives in coming to Florida and living there. I mean, for example, if you're asking a person whose other option within the continental U.S. is to live on a plantation and be a slave, that person is highly motivated to run south to escape and live within the Everglades. But if you're talking about, say, white settlers after the Civil War, they had different reasons. They were interested in being able to afford open land that had not yet been claimed. And so one of the things I do in the book is talk, for example, about Zora Neale Hurston and her family and the stories of settlement that she tells after the Civil War when both settlers, both black and white, were able to find and afford land in Florida because the land there was still open. It hadn't been completely settled already. And people hadn't, they could find places still to live and to afford and to farm communally in some cases. So it just depends on who you ask.
What is one of your favorite stories that you unearth doing your research?
Probably one of my favorites. It's actually hard to say, but I really, the one that's published and that people could also easily find is a captivity narrative that takes place during the Second Seminole War, so in the 1830s and 40s. And for people who may not know, Julie, what a captivity narrative is, it's actually a very popular genre of writing during this period. I teach a lot of different types of captivity narratives, and usually what they are texts written by a person, usually a white woman, who has been taken captive by American Indians and then lives to tell the story. And so these were very gripping stories for people to read because it gave them a perspective on a lifestyle that they usually had no access to and no understanding of. So this one, however, what makes it so interesting to me is that the sort of star of this story is this unexpected character who shows up, who's actually a formerly enslaved person who shows up. He has an axe and he like rescues the main characters. And this is such a strange thing to happen, because to do so, he actually has to betray his Seminole allies. And so there's all kinds of fascinating racial dynamics. And it's called the Story of Mary Godfrey, if anyone wants to find it. I won't give away more.
So these are fictional accounts?
Yes. Almost always captivity narratives were fictional.
So they're made up, but wanting to try to present a picture of what it was like to live?
It's difficult, actually, because there are some that are very much rooted in reality. People were taken captive, and so they would come back and write these stories. But you could never, it's very, very hard to tell how much of that story is true in those cases. And then in other cases, they're made up whole cloth, and the captivity may not have happened. And so it's very difficult to tell with this genre.
That's so funny. I'm kind of thinking it's kind of like an old school form of like CSI. You know, they may be based in reality, but they're not real. But then you don't know how much is for real and what's pulled from the headlines. It's like that.
Yeah. And of course, as a literary scholar, ultimately what interests me more is, well, what was motivating the popularity of this story? That's the question that I try to get my students to ask of these types of genres and that I'm interested in. It's like, okay, we don't know how much is true, how much isn't, but why is it so popular? Why do people want to hear this?
Why do you think it was?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main reasons I started to say before is just that if you think about people living in a settlement or in a neighborhood, you know, going about their lives, they might not know, you know, what it's like to sort of be taken into the wilderness, to live among a different population, to have to adapt, to learn about a different way of life, a different type of food you could be eating, different cultural traditions and different places to live and things to wear. And so I think there was sort of almost like a travel narrative in some ways, sort of fascination with what is it like to go into this place and experience this.
It was kind of one of the last holdouts of Native American culture that was still intact, too. Right?
I don't know if I can speak to that. I'd have to ask like my colleagues in Native studies to know more about whether that's true. But certainly it was and it wasn't. I mean, I know that throughout the 19th century, that culture was repeatedly under attack by, you know, through these wars. But a lot of people remained. And so that culture remains, you know, thriving in many places in Florida, as you know.
Well, they were tough wars for the Europeans to win because that adaptability thing had not yet sunk in, and it still hasn't. Florida's been in the same spot that it's always been. You can go to the southernmost point in Key West there and be 90 miles away from Cuba. Does the Florida Peninsula jutting out into the Caribbean still play a role in how its residents identify? I mean, being carved out from the Spanish population?
You know, I don't know. I'd want to ask the people themselves who live there. I'm not really sure. I think it's interesting because I think today, unfortunately, I think you could live in Florida and not necessarily have that kind of awareness. And it would just depend on where you lived. I remember myself actually not being aware of that much broader multicultural history of Florida, which is shocking to me now, having studied this for so many years. But I grew up in a part along the East Coast, and I, for whatever reason, I didn't have that situated awareness of myself as part of this rich multicultural place. And so I think it would just depend on who you asked.
That's kind of weird. It's really easy depending on not only geography, yeah. but you can kind of subdivide yourself right out.
You can.
You know? I mean, it's interesting how – I mean, did the literature throughout history have much to do with talking about the Spanish influence?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. There is definitely a sense of Spain being the masters of the region. So I'm trying to think of particular examples. But what I can say is that certainly – so the Spanish Florida was part of Spain effectively until 1763 and then again from 1783 to 1821. So it has these two massive periods of Spanish rule. During that time, an enormous amount of maps were made, of surveys – of travel narratives. So what this meant is that when settlers, people interested in settling Florida during the 19th century, when they're trying to understand the landscape, where do they turn? They turn to Spanish sources. And so you have a lot of a sort of long afterlife of these maps made during this earlier period and these narratives and stories about Florida, mostly because people in the U.S. are trying to find information about its people, about its landscape. So, yeah.
It's interesting how that would be the point of reference, you know. These are your reference
yes.
materials, and it's from a different, completely different group of people who no longer
Absolutely.
Have the state. So the debate
yes.
over Florida statehood, it's been settled for a long time now. So what do we learn ultimately from the fact that it was, for so long, an open question?
I think the main thing we learn is the power of local populations, many of whom the U.S. empire was trying to erase or remove, to shape national politics, culture, and literature. I think that's the most important thing. The power of those populations to unite and to push back and to stake a claim to the ground.
Stake a claim for the political ends that they hoped to achieve as well.
Or even just freedom, the desire to like live a life not as a person who's enslaved or even a person who is, for example, seen as an ex-slave, but rather a person who can determine their own future and define themselves in a place that has nothing to do with plantation slavery.
They really did push back for such a long time, but the United States just ended up becoming a state. So they got it. But I wanted to end by mentioning your next book, which is about coral and more
yes.
specifically about what coral meant to early Americans. I mean, it's the job of the coral reef biologist to determine the ecological effects of coral loss. But you, as a literary scholar, you're documenting something else, and that's the cultural and intellectual losses. What are those losses? And why was coral such an important part of everyday early American life?
Yeah, well, this book's going to be a cultural history of coral in the early U.S. And so one thing I think that both of my books suggest and demonstrate is the critical importance of both scientists and people doing the humanities, like literary scholars and historians, to work together, especially during a time like now when we're facing significant ecological and climatological change. While, as you say, it is the job of ecologists to assess those ecological losses, one thing literary scholars can do is show the stories and the histories that emerged from endangered landscapes and, in the case of my second book, endangered materials, and how important those were to the literature and culture of our nation. So, yeah, with this second book, I'm basically showing how coral was an everyday instance in early America of the idea that all nature is intertwined and interconnected, not only with all other parts of nature, but also with humans. It takes all these forces to form a coral reef, for example. And I think that sort of realization of interconnectedness is what I want to bring back and show people was always a part, that ecological awareness was always a part of our nation's culture and history.
Yeah, it's interesting. People think that the green movement is something that's new, but you mentioned that it's always been part of our American psyche.
It absolutely has. From the very beginning, people had to deal with these questions and with this realization of our utter dependence on the landscape.
As much as we might try to deny it and fight against it, it's definitely there.
That's right.
Thank you so much to our guests. We've been talking with Michelle Curry-Navakis, author of Liquid Landscape, Geography and Settlement at the Edge of Early America. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Julie.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, we talk with a Collier County attorney who has some words of advice for renters who've seen damage from the hurricane. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live.